I find Spotify a horrible app to use.
Are you saying that the Spotify algorithm is not as good as the YouTube algorithm?
YouTube's algorithm is so good that it just knows what I want to listen to. However, Spotify as an app is so beautifully done in terms of the UI and like the interface, the way they've made it. I can't switch out to Spotify as much as I would like to use a YouTube.
We, Brand Studio, is a company that designs products, mostly digital products. It's the UI and the UX and the strategy of these digital products.
You went from economics to aerospace to mechanical.
Good design is always not good marketing.
You know, Steve Jobs has a story that the most important course that he took during his brief time at college was a fonts course, how to write calligraphy. And he talks about the whole base, the whole foundation of Apple is set up on that particular course, on how things look, how things feel, and how things can be made.
We get involved in all the phases of the development, which is understanding the needs of the user, understanding the needs of the business, and then kind of architecting with the business leaders what should all those requirements and how do those requirements lock together in a physical manifestation.
If the back end is trash, then everything is trash.
Instagram keep changing, like making small tweaks to their UI, and it's always so frustrating.
I have a counter argument.
Hi, my name is Sudhir Bhatia, and I live right now in Mumbai. I grew up here. I left in 88, so went to the US to study economics. I thought that was the thing to do because I thought, oh, I'll just come back and I'll do business. So I studied economics and I did it for a year, but didn't really like it. So then I switched to engineering, and that was quite a unique shift to go from economics to engineering. I think most people were like, why would you go in that direction? But I went to mechanical engineering and I just loved it. It was fantastic. It was a pretty pivotal moment because I was the whole supply chain demand, this supply and demand kind of world of economics was very abstract. And then I was struggling in the abstract space. And so then I looked deep inside and something told me that it had to be physical. So I said, okay, what is there that's physical? Which profession is physical? And I looked around and mechanical engineering was physical. So I said, okay, I could probably try that. And I was fascinated with aerospace. And I thought when I graduate, I could try to get into the aerospace industry. So I moved to mechanical engineering and I loved it. It was just fantastic. It was the best switch ever. You know, we were doing fluid mechanics and statics and thermodynamics. All these things were really fascinating. And then and we were doing some robotics and stuff like that and finite element modeling. And we had this really interesting professor. He was from, he was a part-time professor. He worked at Kodak, and he worked for a division of Kodak that was making, and he was a finite element modeling like guru. And he taught us what's called statics. We were making compression. We were basically learning how, you know, we designed a high compression tower, and that was part of our finite element modeling program. And we learned about trusses and how the weight distribution would go through a truss and how a truss like that is perfect.
We grew up in India and we start thinking that that's how the world is built. And then, you know, you get to the US and you start thinking, oh, maybe that's how the world is built. And then you realize that the whole North America, US, Canada, they are built around cars. And then when you go to Europe, you realize, oh, that's another way the world can be built, where it's a lot of walking and a lot of biking and a lot of, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely much more is moving more towards sustainability and all of that. So
definitely, and not only that, I think also because of the way the places are, like Europe as a whole is very, very tiny in terms of like distances, whereas North America is massive. So they've sort of bought into that. And I think Europe thrives on public transport, whereas North America mostly thrives on cars.
The world is a very funny place because you know how you went from economics to aerospace to mechanical? I did electrical engineering at Purdue. And from there, I transitioned completely into finance. And a lot of mechanical engineers at Purdue are now doing either computer science work or just transition, you know, into energy work via their masters, and they just transitioned out of mechanical engineering.
So I was about to say that it's usually the transition that happens from engineering to MBA and all that. Here you've gone the opposite way, and it's so lovely to hear, because I see a very often what happens is engineering is oftentimes the first thing that people are thrust into. So I remember Akhil, when I met him, he was doing engineering. And then when he got into finance, the kind of passion that comes through your voice when you speak about mechanical engineering is the way he talks about finance. So maybe it's just a thing that in our undergrad, we don't often realize what the thing is that we want to do.
It's a lot of times you have no idea, right? And the thing is, you keep pivoting. And that's the beauty of life. And I think if you have a growth mindset, you can keep pivoting, and you will 100% in your journey. Somewhere or the other, you'll end up pivoting to something else. A lot of people do. And I think if they're open to it and they're not afraid of it, then, you know, you can take on the excess load, because every time you pivot, there's a period of excess load. But I think if you are a curious person, if you have the fundamental DNA of curiosity, then you can pivot, right? Then it's not a burden. And sometimes pivoting is also, it's just survival. It's a survival instinct, right? You just can't manage what you're doing. And so you pivot. And so survival takes you through that, those tough periods, but I think you grow immensely when you change like that. So I did economics for a year, and then I shifted to university. I went to this small little liberal arts university in Wisconsin called Lawrence University. It was great. I liked it. But then I went to the University
of Rochester. That's where I kind of
moved. I started with economics, but then I shifted to engineering, and everything changed. I mean, it was just fantastic. So I studied engineering and I studied fine art at the same time. I did sculpture and painting, and that was kind of just picking up from what I had been doing with my mom. Had gone to JJ School of Art, and she was a designer herself in text fashion, and so we kind of grew up with that around us. With design, and so taking up sculpture painting as a minor was just normal, and I did that. It was really a lot of fun on the side, besides taking on the engineering classes, right? And what I liked about the engineering, some of them were very practical, and like I was saying, the one where we built this high compression tower with this professor, he gave us a set amount of balsa wood. So we learned how to build it using ANSYS. ANSYS was the finite element modeling program. And I worked throughout my time at university just as a part-time, make some money. And so one of the things I was a TA, and I was the TA for the lab that had all the computers for the finite element modeling. So we could sit at night, and me and my partners, Pete and Natalie, we would sit at night and continue to tweak our design for this high compression tower. And then we came out and then we had to build it out of balsa wood. And simultaneously, I think the TA job was just, I just had to actually take care of the lab. And I had a job with the physics department. I was working for the computer, the guy who was running all the computers for the physics and the astronomy department. And I had a little office. So we were able to set up the office, put a little table, create templates on the table so that when we were building our model, our balsa wood, it was all done very highly precise, right? So the 45 degree angle cuts were perfectly 45 degree angle. We had a template to follow with masking tape on the table, and we were following the structure, and we were building the structure. And it took us three full days not sleeping. And we were graduating, and we come in to the classroom with all the other students, and everybody brings their little towers, and we're going to test it now, and we're going to test it to failure. And so everybody puts their towers. So the concept is you put the tower on a table. There's a hole on the table. There's a wooden plate put on top of the tower, and the tower had to allow for a chain to go through it. It was a steel S hook and a chain attached, and then it went through the table. And at the bottom, there was a bucket hanging off the chain, and then you put heavy weights into the bucket. And we keep adding. So towers are getting smashed. And we come on and we put our weights in, and Peter and me are down very gingerly adding these heavy weights, you know, from the gym into this bucket, adding. Now, bucket hits the floor. And we're like, okay, tower's broken. Let's get out. Come out of the table. Tower's still standing. Oh my God, what happened? The S hook opened up, and I was like, what? So the professor's like, oh. The steel just opened. It was too much weight and the tower didn't break. So I think it was like 600 pounds. Okay. It was like three football players, three very large football players standing on top of this thing. And so then he says, let's change the S hook, put another S hook. And he put that S hook in and put the chain back on. We bet went down. Our other partner, Natalie, was standing outside and watching it. And we were again loaded. Pack, bang, come back out. Tower still standing. It's like, and he's like, okay, we got only one more hook and we have too many more towers to break. We're not testing yours anymore. So till today, our tower is in a little plexiglass box in the mechanical engineering department. In their office, and they take it around, and you know, we have a little plaque in it, and it's kind of fun. But during, and it was 93 and I graduated, and it was a bit of a recession. I don't think everybody got a job, and I think the tower got me my job, because that was my first job, and I got it at a company called Symbol Technologies, where we built mobile computers. And I got into the mechanical engineering department. And I think that had something to do with that, me getting that job. And I keep telling my students, because I teach, you know, I've been teaching for many years, is that you got to do some things really, really well. I mean, you don't have to be great in everything, but you got to do some things damn well.
Sudhir, let's dive a little bit into exactly what your company is doing so that the audience has a little more context about why you are so set on design.
Yeah, so Brand Studio is a company that designs products and digital products today, mostly digital products. It's the UI and the UX and the strategy of these digital products. We get involved in all the phases of the development, which is understanding the needs of the user, understanding the needs of the business, and then kind of architecting with the business leaders what should all those requirements and how do those requirements lock together in a physical manifestation, if you think about it that way. And we bring that physical manifestation over phased approach, which is you start very low fidelity, and slowly, slowly build that fidelity. You'll start with a hand sketch. You might start with just words. And from words, you go to prototypes, clickable prototypes maybe, you'll start adding layers of the brand identity so that it really starts to look like a real product. And ideally, you would want to test it. You know, in most cases, you kind of have to test it. When the world is very agile, you don't always get time to test it. So you take the best foot forward. And when you release it, that's the first test. And then, of course, we get involved also in working with our clients to decide what is the MVP look like, which features should you keep, which features should you not keep, right? And it depends who our clients are. Some clients, large organizations that know exactly what they want, then with those companies, MNCs, you kind of follow suit. They say, this is the feature, this is what we want. Yeah.
Vishrut and I, we like to believe that we are stupid people. We are like monkeys. So let's have you dumb it down. Dumb it down for like 4-year-olds. What do you mean by a physical manifestation of whatever you're designing digitally? And what is fidelity? What do you mean by the word fidelity when you use it? So we would love for you to like just break it down.
So yeah, so when anything that's, you know, I could say, let's take an example. I want to make a application, a digital product, an app or a web product where students can come together and study together. Now, what are you going to do when you come together? First place, how are you going to get people to come together? So then you start asking those questions. How am I going to get people to come together? How do I make groups? And when they come together, what are they going to do? Say one of the things they're going to do is share notes. And I'm talking about K to 12. So you create your notes. You might create digital notes. You might create physical notes. So then you can photograph the notes. Now, where does all that, how do those notes present themselves onto a digital interface, right? So that interface is the physical manifestation. It is, if you look at any app on your mobile phones, somebody has spent a lot of thought and time to decide what the shape of your product's going to look like. I understand it's all it shapes around the limitations of the screen, but within that screen space, if that's your canvas, then within that canvas, what is it going to do? Right. So I'm going to have a button here. I'm going to have entry points to the notes section here. I'm going to have my profile here. I'm going to have a test-taking section here. I might even have a group section here, and I might even have a voice, the ability to call each other. So I might have a phone icon up here. All of that and how all those elements and how those elements come together and where they are placed in an interface is the physical piece of it, right? Then when you click it, it does something. That's the behavior. So I click it and it starts ringing and you're like, oh, okay, other people are getting called and some, you know, things are moving on your screen. So you know it's ringing, right? So that's the behavior part. But the physical part could just be, you know, what we call scaffolding. Think of a building getting built. First, they put up scaffolding. Low fidelity is exactly that. It's the, you can kind of see the skeleton of the building, but you don't know what it's going to look like when the glass is put and you don't know what it's going to look like when it's painted, et cetera, right? Or the trees are there and the landscaping is done. You don't really have a full sense, but you can see, oh, it's this is the height and this is the entrance. And, you know, you can get that. Oh, here's how far high the parking lots are. And then the building starts above. If you think of a skyscraper in a city like Mumbai, right? So from the scaffolding, you know a lot, but you don't know the final finish. And then, so that's what we would do first. Create scaffolding of an interface, a digital interface. Even the interface you're looking at now, where people might be viewing the podcast, there is a viewing screen. There might be a play button. There might be a stop pause button. There might be 10 seconds forward, 10 seconds back, and all of that, those decisions are made first in a very low fidelity, right? How big should this screen be? Should it take my full screen? Should it just be on the corner? Can I chat with people? All kinds of things, right? Somebody's making those decisions based on what the requirements are, what the business wants to do, what the customer wants. What if in this podcast, as people were listening to the podcast later on, post-production, they were able to still chat with people? What if that was even a possibility? Suddenly in this podcast, we could have a thread of conversation on the side where people were commenting and people were replying, maybe not live, but later on, like when the next person watched the podcast, they put a comment, you know, and you see that in YouTube, right? People leave comments. So I'm assuming in your podcast that people would have left comments and they can leave comments. How is that and why do you need that feature? Are all the decisions that get made. And then the first cut of that is in literally you can do a paper sketch. I can take it and draw it on my notebook. And the drawing of it on the notebook takes the conversation two steps further. You know, I call this thing, I keep saying, this is one of the, I like this little analogy. It's like playing chess. Yeah. So sometimes you can't see the seventh move, but if you take two, you can see the seventh move. When you're designing digital products, you can't really design the whole thing on day one because you can't really anticipate all the nuances of the interface or the behaviors that you will cross. You'll only start seeing them when you start designing it. And only after you design the first scaffolding, you're like, oh my God, oh, I need this, I need that, I need this, this, and that. And that's why we work in an agile way, because if we spent time specifying the entire product, we'll never get started. And then the specifications would be so heavy, no one would have the kind of energy to take him on, right? So you have to start light and work with that and then keep bringing things on. But at the same time, while you're doing it, you have to understand that things have to be scalable. So when you design them, you have to have this concept of, okay, how will I make a menu so the menu is scalable? So that I can add other features. Am I only going to be locked with these 10 features? And then there's this whole other concept is what makes good products, right? You can have feature creep and feature creep and feature creep, and you can add like a zillion things into the product and only 10% get used, but you know, what do people really want? What is the value proposition? And I think that's where really good product development, crafting products come in, right? You have to understand the value proposition. You have to understand your user. You've got to understand the business. And then keeping all that in mind, you also have to understand, I can only start with some things. I can't start with everything. I can't even write and specify everything. But I have to design it so that it can scale. But I don't know what's real. I don't know everything that's coming. Right? So there's a craft to it. There's a craft to it. And it's fun.
So here, this point that you raise about design and about, you know, these are the kind of things that you need and this is how it's built up. Funnily enough, a couple of days ago, I was having a conversation with some friends and they're like, oh, you know, YouTube's algorithm is so good that it just knows what I want to listen to. However, Spotify as an app is so beautifully done in terms of the UI and like the interface, the way they've made it. I can't switch out to Spotify as much as I would like to use a YouTube. I'm partial to Spotify simply because it has a better experience.
Are you saying that the Spotify algorithm is not as good as the YouTube algorithm?
That's what my friends claimed. I am not like, this is a discussion that was being had where it was YouTube algorithm is better. YouTube has more of the songs, but because Spotify is so easy to use, I would rather stick to Spotify.
I have a counter argument to that exact analogy, right? I find Spotify a horrible app to use. I think it is one of the most difficult things to get your mind around. Why? Because I am so used to YouTube. I am so used to YouTube Music, right? So when you switch out to Spotify, you have to again see where's the options. How do I shuffle stuff? How do I start a playlist? How do I get to the artist, right? So I want to take the chess analogy further. So chess has something. Earlier, chess used to be just, you know, start pushing pawns, start getting your pieces out and just go wild. Now we have something in chess called opening principles, in which, you know, there are certain ways you play the first 10 moves and then the game is played as a whole. Otherwise, you lose pretty early on in chess, right? When we talk about UI, UX, I feel earlier it was the case that push your pawns, start your game, get stuff out, and then we'll see. Don't you think because of this Spotify, YouTube thing, because people have already learned and there is a high cost to educating them to a newer kind of experience, to a newer kind of user experience, it has kind of become templatized? Where should my options menu go? How the menu works? And don't you think it's losing the charm of it all?
Absolutely. I think so much of it is templatized, and which is why in the future, you will just ask an AI engine to make you a shop, right? Because if I wanted to create a retail shop, if I wanted to, I'm selling jewelry tomorrow, I decide I want to make jewels. And instead of going to one of these Shopify, and Shopify will do it, right? You just tell Shopify, here are my products, make me the shop. And you'll prompt it. You won't sit there and lay anything out. You'll say, here's my logo, here's the, and it'll just make it for you and it'll come out. Because everything is so many digital products are done and are can be replicated. But I would say there's still a lot of interfaces and interactions that are not done. And the world keeps changing and the world keeps evolving and making new things. So if you're making custom products, there will always be a need to understand the customer. What are they trying to do? But yeah, eventually some of the industry products become very easy to templatize, like retail should be quite easy. Your marketing campaign and how you nudge people to come on and onboard and stay and purchase and convert is another problem, right? It's like, that's a business problem. How am I going to entice them to come on and then come back? That's the big problem. People download your app, but they don't come back.
In finance, we have the same problem. So how that works is, let's say you figure out how the stock market works. And let's say you figure out a way to make money. And you say, oh, this is how a stock rises. Tomorrow you write a book about it. I understand that this is how a stock will rise. Day after tomorrow, it'll stop rising on your indicators. Because now everybody knows that works. So I feel marketing faces the same issue when someone knows, oh, this works. And then tomorrow everybody gets to know, oh, this works.
Then people stop coming. Because everybody's doing it. And then they have to innovate again. And then you have to find new methods of marketing, new methods of attracting people. Yeah, that's a challenge, and I think the world just keeps having to innovate. But the products will change, right? I think our needs of today are changing with the environmental impacts, with the need for being more conscious about what's going on in your environment. So we are going to see a shift in the product, and we will see a shift in the service as a result.
So we spoke to Ananya, who runs a design studio in Calcutta. And she said this, that good design is always not good marketing. So what is your theory on this whole good design versus is this marketable or is will this be good marketing? How would you deal with that? What is your take on that?
The way I think of design, and Buckminster Fuller said this, and he's, you know, an innovator from the US, he said something to the extent, when I design and when I'm done and I look back, if it doesn't look good, I know I've done it wrong. But what he's saying is he's designing with all the needs of the product in mind first, right? The needs of the user. So if I design something for the user and make and really bring across the value to the user, and you look back, it will look good. So you don't design with only with aesthetic in mind, you design with the needs in mind. And when you actually fulfill those needs, the product will be fantastic, right? Product. And that doesn't mean you brush aside. This doesn't mean you keep your UI designers or your, you know, you need that. Absolutely, you need that. You need people who can make, who understand font really well. You need people who understand white space, right? But you do it in parallel with, is this even solving a problem? Because if you're not solving a problem, then why are you doing this? It's not art. We're not making art, right? Design is not art, but it is very aesthetic, and it has to be aesthetic. And sometimes aesthetic itself has value. So if I'm designing a back-end ERP system, you could argue that it can look really crappy, right? It doesn't need pixel perfection. It doesn't need good font. The spacing can be, you know, but people who have to use this day in and day out for hours and hours of the day, that their jobs are in running the operations, I think for them, if you give a more pleasant experience, and aesthetic has that ability to give a more pleasant experience, they will perform and they will be more productive and they will be less fatigued and tired and all of that. So your service, your back end will become stronger, which will eventually deliver the front end. And it's a trickle down thing. If the entire company thinks like that, eventually you have very strong, a strong brand, chance of having a very strong brand. And it's all secret because nobody knows that's happening. That's all secret sauce, right? Nobody sees that. Nobody knows exactly what's happening under the hood of within these companies. Right. And a lot of these big companies build a lot of tooling, which is back-end system software, to run their operations. Yes, they'll buy SAP and all of that, but how they structure the SAP, because things like SAP and Oracle, they're like these massive, you know, programs that you can customize. How you customize it, is it giving you the right data? Does your sales guy have the right data? Or you're just populating, I have 200 data points, I'll give him all 200. I'm not going to spend the time thinking of what 200 data points he needs. No, think about what 200 data points he needs and give him 20. Maybe he has a way of getting to the other, you know, 180, but give him 20 because he'll actually be productive then. Give him 200, he's doing all the work. That means you as a designer did no work. And I see that. We go into large companies and we see that, you know, they hire these big organizations to come in and say, set up our back-end ERP system, and then they just populate all the information, and it's useless.
I feel one of the repeating themes on all of our episodes has been balance. And I again feel like there's a good place of balance to be struck between back-end and front-end. Because if the interface is too crappy, than someone who might not be very well versed with computers, which might be a very real possibility in a manufacturing unit. They may not be able to communicate with the interface at all. If the back end is trash, then everything is trash. Then it's just, it's like food looks good and you eat it and it's garbage, right? So that's the kind of thing that might happen.
Yeah, a building is only as strong as its foundation. So you have to have that foundation correctly set up.
If you look at a service blueprint, if you look at the design of a service blueprint, it's built as a cake. It's got layers. And it goes with your partner layer, your back-end layer, your front-end layer, and then the customer layer. So what you do is, and the x-axis is time. So you lay all the interactions or people or pieces of technology in these layers, but then you connect them with lines. And all those lines are points of exchange, very important exchange points. And then you draw this big, you know, sometimes it's their large maps that you put up on the wall so you can see your entire service in one shot. And the stronger your back end, the better your front end, right? So, you know, how often have you said, oh, here's, you go on somebody's website and here's a customer service number, you call the number, nobody to pick up. I mean, what kind of service is that? Right. Then you call, and then just the response is slow. It's just not snappy. It's not. So it's like it goes down to not just tech. It's the training of the back end people. It's all of that. Right. And then it comes to, and I started realizing how important HR is, because it's all about or hiring, how important hiring is and how important the team is and how important having really good training programs and stuff, and that's all part of what makes fantastic companies. That's the secret sauce. That's what nobody can really replicate easily. They can go buy the same software you have, they can buy the same chipset you have, but they can't recreate the culture. So it comes down to also what a fantastic culture you can create.
It's the experience, right? If you look at a restaurant and if you have a very good waiter and the food is not that great, and that person makes you have a really great experience in terms of the way they're like, you know, they're talking to you, they're greeting you, they're telling you about things.
Yeah.
Your experience, you come away that slightly positive, you know, okay, yes, maybe not the best thing, but it was enhanced. However, if the food is really great and all, but you're treated really badly where the person's not willing to explain,
you'll never come back.
Yeah, you're like, Am I doing them a favor by coming here?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Thank you so much. Please keep your good food. I'd rather have a better experience.
What it takes. I think it takes a team. It takes to do all of the pieces, because it's not possible for one person to do it all. And some vision. I mean, you know, when I started working at Amazon, for example, I'm always fascinated by their service. You know, you hit return and then some guy shows up at your door, and their back end is pretty complex to get that person to just show up at your door and take it and take the product and just disappear. The interface, I remember when I worked with Amazon's interface, and I say, oh, this is not such a pretty interface. But they have all the features you need. They give you exactly, they know exactly what you need as a shopper, right?
I feel it's the sheer size of data that they have, that they can realize that this is where it is being clicked, this is what is being watched, this is what is important to the consumer. And then the consumer has created this $3 trillion company, right? So I feel they have so much information that they can really hone it down. I want to go from there.
Also, they are one of the few companies that has not changed its layout or design and all too much over the past few years. Like, in fact, they've only made it easier for people to buy. Literally on your phone, there is a thing you can swipe and your purchase gets completed rather than having to go through the entire checkout
single
process.
Click.
Exactly. And whereas you look at other apps like, you know, like an Instagram or something like that, which keep changing, like making small tweaks to their UI. And it's always so frustrating because you're like, oh my God, I was just used to this button being here and now it's been shifted somewhere else.
But then they add. But the thing is, Amazon adds all kinds of new features like the single click, you know, and you can buy, buy again. Reviews was, I think, the product reviews was all Amazon's invention. And everybody has it now. So yeah, I think they keep bringing, but it's become fairly commodity, right? I mean, if you're creating a retail store, you're 100% going to open up Amazon and study it inside out and say, which pieces of this am I going to take? Which pieces of it can I not take? Because I don't have the infrastructure for it.
The frictionality between me switching from buying from Amazon to me buying from your home store or your mom and pop store is huge. Like, I don't wish to give up the comfort of Amazon for me to go to your local website and buy from you.
So Amazon will have better prices on almost everything. But Big Basket delivers in one slot. And I found the pain. So this is, and this is just the reality, right? Of delivering. Amazon, you order 10 things, they won't come together. They'll come in 10 separate deliveries or maybe 6 deliveries. And I find it painful. The doorbell rings, you're not home, etc., right? What I like about the slotted delivery that Big Basket has is that it comes in the slot. So you can be planned, and it comes in one packet. It comes all together. Now you can have it delivered twice, and I think that's valuable. And I decide for many products now, for like just home groceries and you know, cleaning all the stuff to run the house, I just do it through Big Basket because I don't want to deal with the one delivery, the guy calling you, I need an OTP to come in your building. It's just like this delivery is only going to grow, but they really have to sort out the OTP issue. I'm in a meeting and somebody wants an OTP. I'm like, I'm not going to take that. Forget it. I'm not taking it. Send the packet back. I'm in a meeting.
So here, these problems don't exist. In the US and Canada, you have the option to get it in one box. You have the option. We don't do OTPs here at all. And somebody signs off for it.
I think also the reason for OTPs in India is the added security layer, right? Because there are so many people involved, because there is, you know, there is a doorman, there is a guard, there is a person who's at the lift. So you have to make sure that the package is reaching the right person, because today, if in my building, the guy gives the package to the guard at the main gate and goes away and says, I've given your package and I don't receive that package, Amazon's liable. So they're increasing that so as to make sure that I have actually received my package.
And I get it. And therefore, it is a bit of a challenge. And maybe there is innovation there where some kind of other IoT technology or some kind of sensing technology at your door can be put, or an avatar of you can be left at your door, and you know, you can somehow, you know, the guy doesn't have to call you. You know what I'm saying? So there has to be, there's got to be another better way to do this, you know?
Oh, no, definitely. I think the slotted delivery part that you're talking about is definitely something that I think an Amazon has to get into, because so often the timing that is written, it says, oh yeah, the delivery will get to you by 9 p.m. any time of the day. So like, that's not the best thing, because as you said, you may be somewhere where you're not in the position to give an OTP. And if it's like a 500 rupee package or even a 5,000 rupee package, sometimes you're like, I'm at work. You take the package back, you give it to me another time, but I cannot answer this phone call right now.
I just say one thing and then we can move on if you want. But think of, so we are solving these. I think the big infrastructure problems have been solved by Bezos, and even prior to that, payment, credit cards, internet connectivity, all of that's been solved. And then they built these e-commerce platforms on top. And now we're talking about OTP. Like, we're all like, ooh, OTP. Like, that's the small little, and that's what's making us all excited, right? So I was just thinking, when we were talking about OTP, there's a little feature that's really nice, is, and I don't know if all phones do it, and it doesn't always work, but when you get an OTP, you're on your banking, your payment portal has come up, and it gets you the OTP, but the OTP comes into SMS, and you have to go, before going to SMS, it shows up in your little tray, and you can just select it, it auto-populates, right? That's fantastic, right? Why, when I get in an Uber, can I not just get into the Uber and the OTP from my phone automatically moves into his interface? That now what I'm saying here is, why can't that happen? And it should happen. And why is, when Porter comes to my house to deliver something, I'm sitting in my office, and there should be a technology so that the OTP, it recognizes presence, who I am, you're at the right place, and the OTP automatically goes, and I don't have to be called and disturbed. So these are small, nuanced, we're at a stage where we're like designing these small little, you know, improvements, right?
First world problems, as they say.
Yeah. So why can't, so there is a lot of opportunity to, you know, we have an environmental disaster in our hands, and I think there's probably a lot we can do in that space that still is untapped.
So during your time in business, like 1993, 97, since the 90s till now, has been the biggest transition the world has ever seen, ever. Like, that is, since my birth till now, it's been huge, right? You can take the past 100 million years, and then you can take like the past one century, and then you can take the past 20 years. Like 2007, the iPhone comes out, the world changes. In the 90s, Windows comes out, gets to the masses, the world changes. Internet comes out, the world changes. It's like, it literally changes the way we behave, we interact with the world. For example, 2014, nobody was getting an Uber. Now we can't live without it. Taxis are dead. Nobody cares. It's gone, right? In the finance world, brokerages are dead. Stock brokerages make no money. They're trying
now
to make money on data.
The other,
right?
Way. It's coming back the other way in India with ONDC and stuff. People were not using autos and taxis and all. And now apps like Namayatri and Yatri Sathi in Calcutta, they've like made getting regular yellow cabs or regular autos on the road so much easier and cheaper than Uber.
But again, the broker now no longer is the taxi company. It is still an app, right? So the brokerage fees have gone to dust. My question, Sudhir, is that during your time as a businessman traveling these waters in the midst of the crowd, right? You were right in the middle of the fire every time. What was it like? What was the UI world like? And what was happening in this continuous changing demand from the consumer for whom you were developing? You know, like, what was your thought process? How do we adjust?
Well, I mean, I've seen, you know, like I said, I left India in 88. There was literally one, I remember my mom used to call me, and she had to book a call with a dispatcher, and the phone in the hallway would ring, and some other kid in the hallway would pick up the phone and then come to my door, and hopefully I was in the room at the time, and I would go out and I'd talk to her, and that would be like for 15 minutes, and that would be one call a week or something, right? Now look at where we are now. My kids can call anywhere in the world at almost zero cost, and so there's a massive like change from what I've seen. I mean, I know when, even prior to the iPhone coming out, when the BlackBerry was there, the BlackBerry was definitely king. It did everything, but it was very specific to email, and you had to be kind of part of a company because the company had to have the servers and service, kind of proprietary. And then here comes, and I remember at the time I was at a company called Symbol Technologies, and we were questioning whether these small little QWERTY keyboards were going to be useful. Because like, who's going to be able to type on this small little thing, right? And so we did a whole bunch of experiments inside our company to study how these little keyboards would be functional, et cetera, et cetera. And then Apple came out with a touchscreen keyboard. And again, the whole question was, there's no chance this is going to be useful because you need the tactile feedback. And yeah, everybody got used to these keyboards. So I've always seen it's like new things happen, and then you're always questioning whether they will be useful, and they somehow are able to, they work. And I think the companies who build this stuff, like say Apple Computers built this, the digital keyboard, and it worked. And today we're typing all of our stuff on just these little digital keyboards, very little tactile feedback. You know where the Q, you know where the QWERT is. You just know. Your fingers can move. It's all muscle memory and you can find it. I think it takes a lot of testing. It takes, of course, a leap of faith.
Steve Ballmer came out very famously, 2010. iPhone 3 will be the last iPhone the world has ever seen. This is a failed experiment. I don't know what Apple is thinking, right?
Today we are nearing iPhone 16.
No. Microsoft phones are dead. They don't exist anymore.
No. But you know what the funny thing is? So Windows Mobile was the operating system of the time, right? And so BlackBerry had their thing, but Windows Mobile was the open OS for any company to license and add, and most companies were taking Windows Mobile. But their interface was just not well integrated with the hardware. And that's what Steve Jobs always wanted, was one hardware-software experience. Therefore, they didn't license. I think they licensed iOS maybe once, and then they decided, oh my God, we're never going to license this again. And then they just kept it to themselves. And that integration between hardware-software is so crisp on an iPhone. So the experience is very nice.
And not only just an iPhone, because a lot of people who I know, I mean, Akhil, for starters, he was a hardcore Android and non-Mac, non-Apple kind of guy. And he just bought himself a Mac. And once he did, he's like, dude, I need to get myself an iPhone because this integration is so beautiful. It's so easy to share stuff on, you know, I can copy something on my phone and paste it on my laptop and it happens seamlessly. And the other way around, AirDrop, it's so many other things. It's just calendars being synced up. And, you know, it's just so inherently beautiful about the closed system that, again, you are in the same thing that maybe Android offers you more customizability. It's more open source. It's everything like that. But the way the Apple system functions through your devices is just so convenient.
But I didn't buy an Apple iPhone because they keep putting older hardware into the thing other than the processor. But that's a whole different ballgame discussion. You know, Android versus Apple, never ending.
You haven't bought one yet.
Sudhir, I want to hear your thoughts on, you know, how Windows Phone didn't work. Is it possible that it didn't work because they didn't use the template? iPhone had come out with this template of a home screen. Android just straight up copied that template of the home screen. And then everyone has that particular home screen. And now people are used to icons being on the home screen that I want to use. And then Windows wants you to click on boxes.
No. So I don't... Windows, as I understand, created the app. The concept of launching the app. I just think their integration was not very, the interface, the experience of the interface was not very pleasant. I know from a from BlackBerry. So what did Steve Jobs actually, what did he do, right? He took the app experience, and what is an app? It's just a browser, but it's customized. It's a customized browser. If it's a native app, then of course everything's running on your hardware, like a game. But if it's a hybrid, you know, app, then it's pulling most of the data from the internet. So if I go into, say, a trading app where I'm buying and selling stock, all the information is live. Therefore, it can't be sitting on my phone, and I have to go to the internet and pull it. And that tight integration, where your browser is now customized, every one of these apps, like Swiggy or any of them, they're like just little mini browsers without an internet connection. They're just all blank. It's just a scaffolding with no data. All the data is coming in, filling it up. It's all coming. So you just have this very sweet customized browser. I just don't think Windows, and I don't know the exact story of why Windows failed. I mean, I just don't think they had such a good experience. And I think people were, especially on the BlackBerry, people were going to the browser to get to the internet. And going to the browser to get to the internet on these smaller devices in those days with not very high, decent displays, but not great displays like the high quality displays we have today, was a painful experience. How do you sift through? And probably responsiveness was not really, really well understood, right? At that time, the devices were coming up, these small little devices were coming up, apps. Web developers had to make their websites more responsive to small screens. So all of that was in development. And today, now you can get to so many things just right off the off a browser. You don't have to have an app, right? So Windows probably just wasn't able to, though they tried. I mean, I'm telling you, they did a lot. They definitely tried to make it a good experience. But I don't think they ever were able to achieve that level of fidelity, quality that Apple was able to achieve. And therefore, there was that novelty in the Apple experience that Windows didn't have. And maybe because of the integration, there was a better experience, you know? And so a combination of these things just made it that much better. And Windows was just never able to keep up or become successful. And then eventually, I think, I don't even know, is Windows Mobile even around? I don't even know. It's shut. The department shut. Yeah. Okay.
Since the beginning of the episode, Sudhir, you have a very different approach to design. I'll tell you why I say that. When you talk to people about design, it's usually about blue looks good with orange, or, you know, this button looks better when it's round. But your approach to design has, like, in my opinion, it's been about functionality more than anything else. It's been about the cohesiveness of the experience more than the just the visual beauty of the experience, right? Have you faced problems in the industry because of such an approach where people might not be on the same wavelength as you are? Because whenever we speak to marketing people, it's a very different approach. It's about what people see. And
today's world, everyone cares about number of impressions, number of likes, number of, you know, quick, oh my God, this looks so good. Whereas you seem to talk about a more lasting thing that, okay, if someone is using this regularly, how is their experience getting enhanced? How can I do the best to serve their purpose? What is their purpose? A lot of times, like, I've had this conversation with people who've asked me to look at websites, and I'm like, okay, what's the purpose of your website? And a lot of times they look at me quizzically, that purpose. So I think that's an approach that not a lot of people have. So, okay, so yeah.
I think it depends. So the product development cycle has many phases, right? And at the early phase, when there's strategy, you definitely need to lay down a strong foundation, right? So even if you're working in an agile way, you should lay down a strong foundation so that you can scale and grow whatever you fit. And at that point, people like us are very valuable. If you're a startup and you're just looking for manpower, right? And you've already built your scaffolding, and you just need two guys to do UI, then a lot of times, and not everybody understands, even later on when somebody's just being called on to the UI, they think that they're going to be thinking through all the flows and all the challenges of an interface. And so then they say, oh, let's just hire a UI designer because a UI designer will lay it out for me and it'll look good and that's all that matters. And yeah, so we do sometimes face that challenge where they just want inexpensive resources that are just going to do what they say versus resources that are also going to challenge and think about novel ways of making it happen or making new product. But it all depends where you are in the life cycle. Sometimes in the life cycle, you're so far along, you literally just want somebody to, you know, lay things out and you don't want them to think. And so I think we have most success with clients when they want to build, really think through their problem and build from there, right? It's more challenging when they just want to embellish stuff onto their existing product. And they just want to do, say, a spin and a new look and feel. And I think we could do that. But yeah, sometimes that's a challenge. Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, it's a good question because, and it's interesting that you were able to pinpoint that because that is a bit of a sticky point for us where it's like, oh, people just want stuff to be pretty. But I will say that even UI is a very important step in the journey of product development because eventually what it looks like is kind of where the rubber hits the road, right? Finally, you've decided on all these pieces and what does it actually look like is super, super important. And so it is important. And so, yeah, it is something we constantly are balancing where we want to make great products. And at the same time, it also has to look good. And we don't want to only follow aesthetic because if you only follow aesthetic, then you won't make great product. And so, you know, there is that. But I think most people come to us because they want to make great product. And then we understand that aesthetic will be just part of that journey. It's not the central part of the journey, but it is very important part.
Sudhir, how does one get in touch with you? How does one reach Brand Studio?
So through our website, there's a connect button in there and you can join us from there. And yeah, that's a good way to get to us. And I think, you know, if there's something unique, of course, you can join me on LinkedIn and then write to me directly on LinkedIn through a message. And that would be another way to get me. That would be the easiest ways because I'm always looking at my LinkedIn and we see all our emails that come in to the studio. So, yeah.
Sudhir, I think we've come to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for talking to us. And I think your perspective on design, as we have mentioned multiple times through the episode, is refreshing. So we have a tradition on the podcast where our previous guest has left a question for you. We'd like you to answer that question and give a question for our next guest. So the question for you is, do you think sustainability practices are directly proportional to your bottom line?
Not today. I would not say sustainability practices are something that anybody asks for. We have done sustainability work 100%. We have done social work. And so I would say sustainability, social, enterprise, all of those kind of fall into similar buckets. And it does add to our bottom line for sure. It does. But do they generate profit today? No. They don't generate profit, but they are things that we like to be part of, right? We've done work for several different types of NGOs, and we've worked with farmers to promote sustainability. I think sustainability needs to be part of every operation, right? Every product that is developed. Now, does that mean you have to go plant a tree? No. What that means is that when you're making things, you make them more efficient, effective, and you don't waste time, people's time, so that they can do better things in their life. So, I mean, that's my approach to development. Just make things more, make appropriate products, make proper things. Don't make crap, right? If you make things that are going to not work, then why make them? Then they're not sustainable, right? So sustainable, they've taken energy, they've taken people's time, and that then results in you then again spending more energy to make something else. So that's how I look at it. I'm very interested in the more direct sustainability applications where you are looking at the earth, where you are looking at air quality, water, etc. But finding those opportunities to work in those spaces is a matter of like crossing paths with those kind of people, right? So, but we're very interested in moving in that direction. And companies like Patagonia and Yuvan Chouinard, who's the CEO of Patagonia, are very inspirational to us, and the way Patagonia runs and keeps sustainability in their DNA when they are developing and, you know, producing stuff. So we would love to work in that same way if possible. Yeah.
If I had to ask a question